Raising the state's minimum wage, the pros and the cons. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida voters agreed that the state's minimum wage had to go up, and they agreed, through Amendment 2, that it should go up to $15 an hour. Advocates say it'll improve the overall economy. Businesses, like those in hospitality, are worried this will lead to layoffs. Today, understanding the minimum wage fight, and we take your calls. Also, Governor DeSantis has hired another data expert focused on COVID-19, but he's getting a lot of heat for the hire. The person chosen is an anti-masker and spent years as a sports blogger. Finally,
their losses are in the tens of millions of dollars for the Dolphins alone, so multiply that by 32 teams. Some clubs aren't allowed to have any fans at all in the stands.
How COVID is impacting the Dolphins' bottom line. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Tracking COVID-19 cases and deaths in the state of Florida has been an epic endeavor, and it's been engulfed in controversy. The DeSantis administration once again finds itself making headlines in this story. Earlier last week, they announced that a sports blogger from Ohio, Kyle Lamb, was given the position of data analyst for the state's COVID database. The person now tasked with the job has in the past made claims that the coronavirus was no more dangerous than the flu. A spokesperson for Governor DeSantis has said Lamb isn't a, quote, COVID hire. We're joined now by the Miami Herald's Nicholas Nehamas and Ben Konark. Nick, Ben, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ben, I want to start with you. Who is this guy, Kyle Lamb? What's his background?
Yeah, so I mean, as you just said in the intro, he was an Ohio sports blogger and was pretty known in the Ohio State sports blogging community. That's who he was. And then, you know, March came around and this pandemic, I believe he was driving an Uber to make ends meet. And he started to develop a platform kind of cutting against scientific consensus on the virus and, spreading theories about what he thinks is actually happening, which were always contrary to what scientists are telling us.
Nick, help me understand, please. What are the qualifications that you're supposed to have for a job like this, or is it that the Florida doesn't have any?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, it doesn't appear that Mr. Lamb, certainly he admits that he does not have qualifications to be a COVID-19 analyst. He, you know, says he's not a doctor, he's not an epidemiologist, he's just someone who crunches the numbers. As far as we're aware, he doesn't have a college degree, and it's just extremely surprising that someone who kind of rose to prominence on the fringe of the COVID conspiracy blogosphere in Ohio would find themselves working in Florida's capital.
I mean, what do we know about the search process for this guy? I mean, were there a lot of people? I mean, what do we know?
We have asked the governor's office for those records. They have not responded. We do know that Lamb is a popular person on Twitter in a certain segment of this COVID truther world, if you want to call it that. And in July, a guest on Laura Ingraham's show on Fox News referenced him by name and said he was a really great researcher on this stuff, meaning coronavirus. And so that's when Lamb took off a bit. And we also know that the governor and his staff are frequent watchers of Fox News. The governor is often on Fox News. They're Twitter users, and they read these blogs where these fringe COVID theories are posted by Lamb and others. So this really fits a pattern of how the governors approach a pandemic.
Ben, tell me a little bit about some of these claims, these conspiracy claims that this gentleman has been spreading online.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would put them in different buckets, right? I mean, some of them are honestly kind of laughable on their face, right? You're talking about this possibly being part of a Chinese bio war, or, the fact that masks don't work when there's, you know, tons of evidence to the contrary. Then there are other claims that I think are a little trickier. For instance, when Nick earlier mentioned the Fox News appearance, he had erroneously claimed that people were testing positive, multiple times in Ohio, which is true. People test positive for the coronavirus multiple times all the time. But he was claiming that these were being counted numerous times to kind of suggest that the numbers were being inflated. And this is a common theme we see across a lot of these conspiracy theories. They take a little piece of data and they try to twist it to fit a narrative, which is that the pandemic is not as bad as people are telling you it is. So there were a lot of claims like that. There are a lot of graphs, that might suggest that I've seen graphs that he's posted that suggest that deaths are, there's something wrong there, that, they'll basically just, quite frankly, poorly execute a data visualization and then suggest that, their mistake is suggestive of some larger conspiracy.
Nick, tell me, what is his job going to be here in Florida? What's he supposed to do?
So it's an entry level job in the governor's office of policy and budget. And he has said that his work will include coronavirus. The governor's spokesman told us that it would not exclusively be coronavirus, and then kind of walked that back with CNN and is saying, it's not a coronavirus hire at all. So he'll be helping the governor with the budget, with coronavirus, with other matters. Again, it's just not really clear how he actually got this job, which pays $40,000 a year.
And I'm wondering, how influential is this information that he's going to be gathering? How is it going to be? How influential will it be in the state's actions on COVID-19?
So the governor's spokesman made a point of telling us that any work that Lam does will pass through about 10 pairs of hands before it gets to the governor's office. But I don't think you can deny that there's a reason Lam was brought into this office. He is, aside from his coverage of Ohio State University sports, he's well known for coronavirus. So why are you going to bring him in if it's not to work at least partially on that? Now, a former employer of Lam's tweeted that he is skilled with data analysis, but being good at data analysis and, knowing how to analyze pandemic data or state budget data is not necessarily the same set of skills.
And of course, as you've been saying, you've constantly been asking for the governor's response to these questions, but he's been criticized a lot for this move. What is the response to the criticism?
It's been very silent so far. We've asked a bunch of follow-up questions to the governor's office and we haven't heard back, although we've seen the governor's spokesman on Twitter. So we're waiting to get some answers, more answers, and waiting for our public records requests, which I have to say have been extremely slow in coming back since the pandemic began and even before that.
And you're going to publish a story soon about congressional Democrats calling for Lam to resign.
Yes, so we just posted that. If listeners want to go to miamiherald.com, they can find out all the details, but that's correct. 10 members of Florida's Democratic delegation to the U.S. House of Representatives are calling on Governor DeSantis to remove Lam from his position, saying that he represents a threat to the health and safety of Floridians. And that view was echoed by some state-level Democrats that we interviewed for the story as well.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Ben Konark and Nicholas Nehemas. We're talking about Kyle Lam. He's a data analyst that was recently hired by the DeSantis administration to track COVID data and help keep the state's coronavirus database. And you can read more of their reporting on this. Find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Learn a little bit more about his background, who this guy is, where he's coming from. Ben, you heard from a professor in Harvard School of Public Health. You mentioned a moment ago. What concerns are there on a larger scale about how the DeSantis administration has handled this pandemic?
Yeah, I think that this is kind of a story that goes back to March, where there was some criticism early on about the lack of a statewide mask mandate. There was some criticism early on about a no statewide shutdown order. The criticisms, I would say, were kind of mild until about May, when we started to reopen and public health experts were warning us that this was happening way too soon and that we weren't ready to reopen. What followed was obviously a travesty. It was a summer surge that took, thousands of lives. We saw the systems that had been propped up totally collapse during that surge. Testing, wasn't happening nearly as much as it should happen, and the results were delayed by weeks. contact tracing was not happening. Hospitals were overwhelmed here in Miami. And, you know, since that surge, it's just gotten worse, really. You know, just about every move that the governor has made has come under fire. You know, one of that being, you know, this idea of, you know, lifting all indoor dining restrictions or opening bars, things that really other states have not done. And then I would say kind of the, you know, the latest point of emphasis in this was the roundtable that the governor had at the end of September, where he invited a lot of kind of contrarian thinkers and scientists who have views that go against the scientific consensus on a pandemic, and highlighted their views to kind of provide justification for how he was going to approach this going forward.
And you've also been writing about these concerns that the state may be discreetly pursuing herd immunity, a herd immunity strategy. What evidence justifies this claim?
Right. So, you know, the idea behind a, you know, I would even hesitate to call it a strategy, right? The idea is that you no longer try to contain a virus. I've often heard it explained as, oh, it's too contagious to try to contain it, and no one's had success containing it. So you're basically allowing the virus to spread freely among younger people, people who you think are healthier. And I stress the think, because we don't really know what leads to severe symptoms and what doesn't. We know that the chances of developing severe symptoms are a lot lower for certain age groups, but there's obviously a lot we still don't know. So the idea is that you will try to shield the quote unquote most vulnerable, again, who we think are the most vulnerable, and let the virus kind of spread freely among everyone else. And I don't think you have to squint too much to see how that's happening, right? You've removed all restrictions, you've taken away the ability of local jurisdictions to enforce mask mandates. You've, you know, brought the curfew under legal question. I mean, just about every public health measure we've tried here has been undercut by the governor.
And speaking again on this herd immunity, I mean, this is an issue we talked about extensively. And back in September, we spoke with a Dr. Anthony Harris, medical director and chief innovation officer for WorkCare, who explained why herd immunity is a dangerous proposal.
Herd immunity, I mean, if we left, you know, coronavirus to its own druthers, right, and the population was subject to it, we did nothing of prevention, right, we would reach herd immunity once about 70% of the people, begin to 60%, but about 70% is what is needed in general to achieve herd immunity, where those who have been affected and recovered are now protecting others who have not encountered COVID, because they are basically a barrier to transmission, right? Now, all that flies out, no matter your, I guess, belief that herd immunity is the way to go and the method to get us on the other side of this or not, where herd immunity now and what we know about COVID breaks down dramatically is because now we have our first confirmed reinfection case out of Hong Kong,
right,
where genetic, yeah, and so now that the notion of reinfection has been observed objectively, determined by genetic breakdown of the virus.
So, Ben, I mean, what have you heard from Democrats in the state about what the governor's doing? And this, again, this idea of maybe going in that direction of herd immunity.
I mean, I think there's a lot of concern that what we're going to see is hospitalizations rise and then deaths rise. That's typically how this progresses. We see cases rise, hospitalizations rise. And we're seeing that now. And then eventually we see deaths start to rise. So, you know, those are the stakes here. I think Democrats are also concerned that they haven't seen any justification for these moves, right? You know, it's just kind of been handed down to us from the governor's office, and we haven't heard a lot directly from the governor on why this is what, you know, this quote unquote strategy he's pursuing and what his reasoning is for that. So I think those are the main concerns.
Nick, in January, President-elect Joe Biden is going to be sworn into office. He said repeatedly on the campaign trail that he plans to implement a national mask mandate. I mean, are we expecting a showdown between, you know, the federal government and DeSantis?
Well, I think it's an open question about what Biden as president could actually do to implement and enforce a national mask mandate. Even if he signs an executive order, he can't enforce that except on federal property, really. I mean, what's he going to have the FBI running around state and local jurisdictions, writing people up for not wearing masks. So it's really more of a symbolic kind of gesture. But and we have seen states, including Republican states like Utah, move toward mask mandates. But that's something that has absolutely been opposed by DeSantis here in Florida.
But could the federal government perhaps just like cut funding or find other ways to threaten the state?
That could be a possibility. I mean, like they've done with seatbelts, but it will certainly be a contentious political issue. And I think there'll be a lot of concern from Republicans that it's a violation of state rights.
And it almost has that sense of like, the version of Rick Scott versus Obama. I mean, what are the implications of a fight like that?
Well, I think it takes what scientists want to be a scientific discussion based on evidence and makes it into a political and culture war. And I think the hiring of Kyle Lamb by Governor DeSantis, who has been said really does not believe in the clear science behind masks, shows exactly where the governor stands on this issue and suggests that he would fight any move by the federal government to implement a mask mandate here in Florida.
And meanwhile, again, COVID cases back up on the rise nationwide. We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Nick Nehemas and Ben Konark. Again, follow their stories on this and other issues around the pandemic and the DeSantis administration on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Ben, Nick, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, Floridians voted to raise the state's minimum wage. What impact will it have on businesses, large and small? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the last time that Florida's minimum wage was increased, that was back in 2004. Starting next year, it will increase again and continue to do so every year until it reaches $15 an hour by the year 2026. Right now, it's at $8.56 an hour. Voters made the decision to raise the minimum wage after overwhelmingly supporting Amendment 2. Now, some workers feel this is long overdue. Some businesses feel this could ruin them. Sean Snaith is the director of the University of Central Florida's Institute for Economic Forecasting, and he joins us now. Sean, thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And by the way, we want to hear from you. If you're a business owner or perhaps you're an employee making minimum wage, tell us how you feel about this. Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You know, Sean, I want to start with this. To understand this years-long battle over minimum wage, mm-hmm. Remind us how minimum wage was created in the first place. So what how we even got here?
Well, the origins of it, I'm not sure, but this has been, a long battle here in this push by various groups to get to a $15 minimum wage. And I think the key thing to understand when trying to assess the impact of what this is going to mean is something that those who took an introductory economics class learned early on in the semester, and that is something called the law of demand. And the law of demand is not enforced by ballot initiatives or courts or lawyers or governors. It's enforced by the actions of millions of individuals that interact through markets. And the law of demand tells us that when you raise the price of something, the quantity demanded of that thing will go down. And so the law of demand hasn't been overturned by Amendment 2. It's still in place. It's the reason why when you go to Publix, you see these offers of buy one, get one. That's the law of demand. They're lowering the price to sell more of a product. They're trying to get off their shelves. So this is still in place. And so we're raising the price of less skilled labor. That means the quantity of less skilled labor will go down. That's really indisputable.
Yeah.
How businesses react, there's a lot of possibilities here, and so it's difficult to say.
Let's see, because we're going to, I want to look into how it could affect different groups. And we've been hearing over time from different people, business owners who've said, you know, this could ruin them. But, I wanted to get to, where else has the minimum wage been raised in the country that we can look at and say, all right, see, they've already tried the experiment, so we can at least look at them. Where have we seen that?
Well, we've seen it largely in high cost of living areas around the country. Some of the laboratory experiments, if you will, have been in Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City. Some states have already, made the move towards a statewide $15 minimum wage. And, the studies are mixed, quite frankly, in terms of what the impact has been. And it usually depends, the outcome of the study or the conclusions of the study depends on who funded it. But there was one study done by a group of economists at the University of Washington that was independent, wasn't funded by an outside group. And they looked at restaurant workers in the Seattle area, and they didn't look at unemployment rates. They didn't look at the number of people working in restaurants, because those can be affected by other things in the economy. They looked at individual worker data. And what they found is that these workers, even though the number of them being employed in Seattle had increased over their study period, the individual workers had saw their income go down by about $140 a month. And so this is one way that businesses can respond to this. They might not necessarily cut hours.
Cut hours. Interesting.
They may substitute away from lesser skilled labor. And so I think you'll see more self-checkout lanes in retail
automation.
Places. Automation. I think this will accelerate that. Process.
Yeah. I want to put the number back out there. It's 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. I want to hear from, if you're making minimum wage, how you feel about this. But if you're a business owner, especially, I want to hear what you think, your thoughts on, raising the minimum wage. As we just heard Sean say, is it going to lead to more automation? You're going to start cutting hours? Do you think you'll have to lay people off? 800-743-9576. I wanted to go to, I've got a bartender in here in Brickell, I believe it is. I don't have the name.
Michael,
welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, go ahead, Michael. What's your thought? How do you feel about Amendment 2, and what do you think about raising the minimum wage?
I mean, yes, you guys do have a point. There will be definitely some more auto stuff that will happen, and then you'll have people that will be cut out because they have to have that, for their businesses and stuff like that, because they can't pay them correctly, right? But that goes back to the employer, if you're not being paid correctly, or like I had somebody tell me how they're really mad that, I think it's unfair that McDonald's workers can be paid $15. And I went to school and I took out a bunch of loans just to be able to make $17 as a nurse. And I'm like, well, don't be mad at us for that. Like, be mad at your employer, because that doesn't fall on us. And I think even if I do have to pay an extra $2-3 on that McChicken or whatever, that if somebody else can be able to live finally on at least a little bit better than they were before, I think that's amazing, honestly.
All right.
To be able to put food on the table,
Michael, thank you for the call. Thank you for the insight. Sean, do prices have to go up if we raise the minimum wage?
Well, again, the Amendment 2 isn't manna from heaven that's just going to, rain down into the pockets of our minimum wage workers in the state. It's got to come from somewhere. Some businesses will be able to pass on higher prices to customers as a way to ameliorate the impacts of having to pay a higher minimum wage. Others may not be able to do so. If you're one, you're running a small Chinese restaurant, and there's 25, 30 competitors within 10 miles of you, you're not going to be able to just decide that you're going to charge more for your product with all those competitors around. So some businesses will be able to pass it along, which in turn will result higher prices for the same people who may benefit from a higher minimum wage. So it's there'll be winners and losers without a doubt. And if you can stay in your minimum wage job and your hours are not reduced, your take home pay is going to go up. Now you may face higher prices with that take home pay. So how much better off are you as a result? And I think about young people trying to get their first job, are going to be kept out of the labor market.
Right, right. Again, phones lit up right now. We'll take some more calls here in a minute. We're also getting comments and questions via Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at WLRN Sundial. David in Miami Beach wrote us, I own several stores in North Miami Beach. There's barely any business there. At this point, if I have to raise my employee's salary to $15 an hour, I will close all of my stores because I won't be able to pay them. This increase in salary for employees should have been for employees working for larger companies that can afford to pay them, not for smaller companies like myself that are barely getting along, especially in this pandemic. It comes down to the big businesses, small businesses. I mean, you have this, the Targets and the McDonald's can pay it, but maybe that independent owner can't do this. What do you think is going to happen to a person like David?
That's the other aspect of minimum wage laws, whether they're statewide or national, is, one size does not fit all. The labor market in Miami-Dade is quite different from the labor market, in Apalachicola, Florida. The cost of living and so forth is quite different in those areas. They're just different markets. And so setting one price for all these different markets will cause a varying degree of displacement, depending on how far above what the market wage would be on its own in absence of Amendment 2. But, the story we just heard, is true. What will he shut down? Perhaps. Will he cut hours? Perhaps. There's options, for business owners, and they're not going to just sit idly by and do nothing but pay a higher wage. There'll be changes.
Yeah. Well, there was a study by the Florida Policy Institute that found that Amendment 2's wage increase will bring in $577 million in sales tax revenue to the state by the time it's fully implemented, again, by 2026. Alexis Davis is the policy analyst who authored the report.
This is based on economic studies that show that when individuals used to living on low incomes receive a boost in pay, they almost always go back out and spend that money locally, infusing revenue into businesses and ultimately sales tax into the state. And this remains true even when businesses modestly increase prices to adjust for those higher labor costs. Everyday Floridians are the ones who pay the most in sales tax, more than businesses and tourists combined. So when it comes to sales tax revenue, working Floridians are going to be the ones who carry the state's post-pandemic recovery.
So she talked about this post-pandemic recovery. I wanted to ask you about, Sean, is we don't know how long this impact's going to be. Could the implementation of Amendment 2 help Florida's economy, or do we have to wait? Hold on a second. We're dealing with a pandemic here.
Well, I've written and expressed, I don't think this was a good idea pre-pandemic in February when, Florida's labor market was in fantastic shape. And it was just precisely these workers that were making the biggest gains at that time. The fastest wage growth that was happening was those in the lowest income classifications. So here we are, post-pandemic or nearing the end or emerging from the recession. And who bore most of the damage of these lockdowns from the pandemic? It was these lesser skilled, lower paid workers and small businesses. And so at the time when they're hurting most, we're starting to implement changes that is going to make it difficult for both these groups to get back to where they were pre-pandemic.
Again, I'm talking with Sean Snaith. He's the director of the University of Central Florida's Institute for Economic Forecasting. We're talking about Amendment 2. It passed with a supermajority, and it's going to raise the minimum wage in the state to $10 in 2021, and it'll go up a dollar every year until we get to $15 an hour by 2026. We'd like to hear from you. If you're getting through the line, that's great. If not, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I want to go to the phones now. Let's go to West Palm Beach. I got David waiting. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Go ahead, David.
So my thought on it is that so if there's millions of people that make a dollar more an hour on a 40-hour week, that means they made $40 more. Yeah, it took it from the employer, and I'm not advocating that I want to take from an employer, but wages have been suppressed for 30 years now through illegal labor. So now we're going to raise minimum wage, and those people are going to be able to afford, with $40, they'll be able to afford to go out and go out for dinner one night a week, or they'll be able to pay their power bill, or it'll allow people to be able to pay their bills more, because the minimum wage right now isn't a sustainable living wage. I know the argument that it's not supposed to be, but there's a heck of a lot of people living on it.
Yeah. Sean, is there evidence to justify what David's saying?
Well, you know, you got to remember this extra money is not, you know, falling from heaven. It's coming from somewhere else. And that may very well be a small business owner who doesn't have that extra $40. So, I mean, we're making a bit of a transfer here. But, you know, the realities about the minimum wage worker is that a very, very small percentage of these workers are heads of households, people that are trying to, you know, be the primary breadwinner in a household on minimum wage. And of course, you can't do that, and you won't be able to do it at $15 for that matter. But there are other programs to help these families, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit federally. And that's a targeted assistance that's not going to carry with it the collateral damage to other minimum wage workers who might, you know, they might be the third or fourth income earner in a household, but that money they bring in helps the household. They might be a student working part-time after school, you know, to help bring in food to feed their siblings.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's again, a very sledgehammer type tool, when I think we could help those struggling households with something more like a scalpel.
Yeah. And again, thank you, David, from West Palm Beach, for your call. Now, we did hear from Zach Stern. He's the owner of Zach the Baker in Wynwood, and he had already started paying his workers $15 minimum this year.
We thought the right way to do it was to eliminate tipping and its replace, put a service charge, so that we can take that service charge and we can spread it over the entire company from the front to the back of the house. That way, the servers got a living wage, but also the dishwashers and the line cooks got a living wage. But turns out it was a bit too much, and it was a bit too fast, and the servers weren't really on board, and the community didn't really understand what we were trying to do. And so we shifted our strategy towards a more incremental approach, where we started at $12, and year over year we would increase to 13, to 14, to 15, until finally last quarter, unceremoniously, we got to 15. It's not something that we talk about in the company, but it's something that I'm quite proud of.
All right, so I mean, Sean, incremental. Again, we're not jumping to $15 an hour. We're doing
right.
This year by year by year. Is that going to make it a little bit easier?
Well, it's gonna. If we did it all at once, then we would see what the true impact of this is going to be, and it would you know, be very apparent. You know, I think you can boil a frog by tossing it into a pot of bubbling water, or you could just slowly turn up the heat. You know, the end result is you've got a boiled frog at the end of the day, and the disruption will really depend on where that minimum wage is relative to what that market wage would be in whatever year of this process that we're talking about. And so if you look at the percent increases that this mandates to the minimum wage, highly unlikely that we would have seen the market increase wages at that same clip, because
right.
we were doing great, as I said, pre-pandemic, but that wage growth was still 5.5%. It wasn't 10%+ like we're seeing now.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this too, because of the higher income, there could be families who lose their eligibility for public assistance and benefit programs, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, this is the real danger with, you know, sort of trying to, you know, I think this is largely, aside from the unions who have some self-interest, I think most people that support it, you know, there's a sort of moral component to these initiatives. But, you know, looking at it holistically, there are cutoffs for some of these programs. And so has the welfare of these families. Yeah, they might be taking home a bigger paycheck, but now they're not eligible for other types of support. So are they really better off at the end of the day?
All right, I want to go back to the phones. And again, talking about Amendment 2 and raising the minimum wage. It won't get up to $15 an hour till 2026, but it will start going up starting next September. Let me go to Juan in Miami. Juan, you're a business owner.
Yes, sir. Well, I own a tractor trailer, so I really don't deal with employees or okay. anything like that. But there's a couple of things that gentleman that's with you has said that I don't agree with. He said, one of the things he said was that most people that are making minimum wage, they're at second and third on the list of bringing, you know, money home. And I don't agree with that. Some of them are the primary homeowners. You know, the average price of a house in Dade County is around $350,000, $400,000. A two-bedroom apartment is going for $2,000 a month. How do you expect? I would like to ask him, if he made $850 an hour, would he be able to survive and have all the luxuries and all the benefits and all the nice things he has, you know? And the answer would be no, of course. He wouldn't survive. He'd have to have three people in his family working together with him to try to make the, you know, the mortgage payment or the rent payment at the end of the month.
Let me turn it over to him. Sean, I mean, you hear this. Look, this is a hospitality town, right? We have a lot of people who work in restaurants and hotels, so they're either at the minimum wage or somewhere near that. Life's tough in a city this expensive, but so many people are living in that realm. So isn't this something that's needed in a place like this?
Well, you know, I mean, my statements about the characteristics of minimum wage earners are based on a report that's put out annually by the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they break down exactly who these workers are, the demographics, the age, the household structure of people that are earning minimum wage. And I personally grew up in poverty. On public assistance, and I understand the struggle and the allure of, you know, somehow an amendment's going to alleviate that. But, you know, the reality is it's going to cause distortions and may hurt some of the very people that the proponents suggest.
Well, let me just, you got 30 seconds to answer this. I want to know, because you said it earlier, businesses may have to alter things. Do you think it's going to be the business community that has to alter things to work around the increase, or do you think state lawmakers are going to jump in and try to find a way to slow down the increase?
Well, yeah, I the only thing more difficult to predict than the economy is what politicians are going to do. But I do know that businesses, just like individuals, react when prices in the economy change. Their behavior will change without doubt.
Sean Snaith, again, director of the University of Central Florida's Institute for Economic Forecasting. Sean, thank you for the insight. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And, you know, we're still hearing from people on Facebook, like Raymond Powell. He messaged us. He said, when I started working in this country in 1983, the minimum wage was $2.35. I think $15 would not be an issue. If the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies will get less from their millions of dollars for their bonuses, small businesses earning a profit less than a million should be compensated by the state or federal government employees. We also heard from David Peary on Twitter. He says Florida is already paying the cost of an unlivable minimum wage through increased the working poor's dependence on SNAP, Medicaid, and other public assistance. If an employer can't pay a livable minimum wage, they shouldn't be in business. This is one of those issues, and it'll be something we'll continue to talk about because, again, that first increase starts next September. Thanks again to all our callers, and you can continue the conversation on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the Miami Dolphins are winning, but they're also struggling with COVID. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Miami Dolphins are on a streak. They're winning. They won their last three games. They're sitting just below Buffalo in the AFC East at 5-3. And their success in part has come with the introduction of this rookie sensation. You may have heard of him, Tua Tagovailoa, whose quarterback play has been very good. At least it was last week. While the team looks solid on the field, they are struggling right now to contain the coronavirus within their staff. Five assistant coaches weren't allowed to be on the field for last week's game because of COVID protocols. Hard Rock Stadium has instituted strict COVID protocols for fans, limiting it to 13,000 people at a game and restricting where they can even go, where they can sit. Earlier today, I spoke with Adam Beasley, sports reporter for the Miami Herald, talking about the Dolphins. Adam, the team has had issues with COVID. Some of the coaches have gotten it. How is the team and the league taking the pandemic safety protocols? I mean, are they taking it seriously?
Oh, 100%, because they know that if they don't take it seriously and there's a major outbreak, they're going to have to either, you know, postpone or cancel the season altogether. They're wide-eyed about, open-eyed about what the challenges of this pandemic are. I'll paint a picture for you. This morning, I go for testing, and I went down to the Dolphins facility, and as soon as I got out of my car, you wear a mask outside, inside the entire time. You walk into a trailer, they have your information, you sit down, you get swabbed, and you're out within 30 seconds. And you've got to pass three of those tests in a row just to cover practice. And at practice, we're far away from the players and the coaches. It's not like we're on top of them. So if they're taking those kind of measures for us, for we the media, you can imagine what they're doing for people inside the building. Masks are always mandatory. The Dolphins are in the intensive protocol, they call it, because they've had a couple of issues within the last couple of weeks. And they're not allowed to have in-person meetings. Their meetings have to be all via Zoom. The players can come in, practice, go home, and do their meetings there. It's a lot of unknown still, because we haven't hit the worst of it yet. South Florida, thankfully, isn't as bad as other places in the country. But, I mean, you talk about Green Bay over the last month has been just incredible. It's just horrendous with the numbers they've had. So the NFL navigating that, it's been hugely challenging, particularly because they don't have a bubble.
What's it like at the stadium? Because I know, I mean, we allow in Miami some fans. I don't know if all stadiums now allow some fans, but I mean, it's limited. So what's that like? How do they keep people, like, are there concessions? How do they keep people safe in other parts of the stadium?
Yeah, it looks like basically any other store that you walk into. There are dots on the ground where you should stand, so you're 6 feet socially distanced from the person in front of you waiting in line. The capacity is way down. I think the Dolphins allow 13,000 people, which is essentially a fifth of the stadium. And it's not like, okay, you know, the honor system, you sit where you're supposed to sit. Seats that are not in use are zip tied closed, so you cannot use them. They're inaccessible to anyone who would want to sit there and move their seats. When you're sitting in your seat, you have to be masked up at all times unless you're eating and drinking, and they will kick people out if they aren't wearing masks.
You know, I think about when I started in the business and I was a sports guy, and you go to the games and we're all stuffed into the press box. We'll all go down to the field near the end of the game and follow the players in the locker room, and then we're all stuffed in the locker room. Obviously, all of that has changed, but you're still in a press box. So what's different now?
Well, the Dolphins have the plexiglass dividers between seats. We're not on top of each other. They used to cram us all in, so there is more spacing. Those of us, there are different tiers of access. I'm in what's called tier two because I get tested. There are members of the media that do not get tested. They're in tier three. They isolate us from them. So it really is a high level of diligence that they go through. And I think the biggest point is that we're not anywhere near the coaches or players on game days. It used to be after the game was over, we would go down and listen to Brian Flores in the media room and then go into the locker room and have unfettered access to the players. That's completely gone. There's none of that anymore, and there might not be any of that next year either. I don't know how quickly the NFL is going to want to rush back into letting us into that private space.
But how do you do that? I mean, like, because after the game, you'd be in the locker room talking to players, you'd have access to coaches. How do you do your job when you don't have access to these people?
Poorly. I mean, it's not the same level of coverage that we've had in years past. It just isn't. There are Zoom availabilities. We talked to the head coach and we talked to four or five players after the game. But look, I mean, there are, I think five of us traveled to Phoenix at home games. There are dozens of local members of the media. It's really hard to have a fresh, unique, exclusive take when we're all using basically the same 10, 15 minutes of content. It's really, really hard to do. So you have to be creative. You have to have sources inside and outside the building that you can talk to beyond the Zooms. But again, our industry is suffering just like every other industry on the planet is suffering right now, except for maybe Zoom. I mean, if you're a business that needs in-person contact like journalism does for the most part, it's just not going to be the same.
I'm talking with Adam Beasley, Miami Dolphins beat reporter for the Miami Herald, talking about how the team and the league are handling COVID and why the team's looking pretty good right now. What about, you know what I'm wondering? I mean, what have you heard from the team or the league about, you know, they're trying to get more fans in, COVID numbers are going up, but I mean, the NFL, it makes a ton of money every year, and it's going to lose a lot. Not having those fans, how is that hurting the
team? Oh, eight figures. I mean, their losses are in the tens of millions of dollars for the Dolphins alone. So multiply that by 32 teams. And some, you know, some clubs aren't allowed to have any fans at all in the stands still. So, no, it's a billion-dollar hole that the NFL is staring at, maybe more, because of COVID. But you know what? A $1 billion hole is better than a $4 billion hole or a $5 billion hole. And that could be what the league would face if there wasn't some sort of football. TV money is still king. It still drives the much, if not most, of the revenue of the NFL. And look, that's not going anywhere. And I know the ratings have been kind of soft. They're improving in Miami because of the quarterback change to Tua Tagovailoa. But still, if you have that base of network TV money, you can survive a year of this. Can you survive 2 years of this? Then things get kind of tough. But you will see the NFL in 2021 most likely have a reduced salary cap. I think it's going to be down 10-15% from last year. And that's just a reflection of the reduced revenues from 2020.
And you got to think about all those people in the concessions and people who were making money working off the having a packed stadium. You know, I was wondering if you knew, but I mean, Hard Rock Stadium is supposed to host the college championship. Do we know what's going on with that? Is that still on?
From what I hear, yes. I mean, college football has got much bigger issues than the NFL because they're amateur athletes. I mean, we say that in air quotes because they're really professional athletes that don't get paid. But there are standards that are collectively bargained by the NFL and the NFLPA that simply don't apply to college athletes. They're not. And so you're going to see massive cancellations as we go forward. You already have seen a bunch of games canceled. I think the NCAA is just going to close their eyes, cross their fingers, and try to, you know, force their way through the finish line and award a champion at the end of the season. And as you mentioned, that champion will be crowned at Hard Rock Stadium. Here's something crazy to consider. Right now, the NFL is on track to finish their regular season, I believe, on January 3rd. It's a 17-week season, 256 games crammed into 17 weeks. The problem is this. We're already past the bye week for a lot of teams, and that bye week is where you have wiggle room. If you have a cancellation or a postponement due to COVID, and you're past your bye, you're going to have to either cancel the game altogether or play an 18th week. And if they play an 18th week, the Dolphins could conceivably play their last game of the regular season at home the night before the college football championship game is to be played on that same very field. So talk about a crazy turnaround. You wonder what the condition of the playing surface will be. There are so many things that you would have to worry about that you never thought of before. Of course, the same thing could happen if the Dolphins make the playoffs. I mean, if Dolphins make the playoffs and somehow host a playoff game, it could happen even if there isn't a postponement of the season. But there are so many moving parts for that building, for that league, for college football. They're all trying to make it work, and COVID doesn't care about any of that.
All right, let's finish on this, have a little fun. I think I've become such a cynical South Florida sports fan. I've been so used to not having winning teams, and then I stopped and realized, wait a second, we've had a pretty good year. The Marlins made the playoffs. The Heat went to the championship. You know, the Hurricanes are playing well and the Dolphins are playing well. So maybe I shouldn't be complaining. I got to ask you, cause it's interesting. Like there was so much talk about this kid Tua, the little that you get to actually interact with players and coaches, is he the guy everybody was hoping he would be?
Right. Yeah. Now I didn't have that personal experience, so I can't speak to that, but I will say this. Ryan Fitzpatrick is beloved in that locker room, but you know what they love more than Ryan Fitzpatrick? Winning. And so if Tua Tagovailoa turns them into a consistent, high-level team, we're going to say, thanks for your service, Fitz. It's Tua time. And I think that's kind of what Brian Flores, the Dolphins head coach, did. I'm not ready yet to get out on that ledge that you are and say he's the next Marino. I'm going to bide my time a little bit and wait for the sample size to grow a bit. I mean, we're only, what, two games and one drive into the Tagovailoa era?
I'm desperate.
Well, I will say this. All signs have been encouraging, okay? And so if you want to have optimism for the first time in decades, Dolphins fans, this is your moment. He has got the complete package, the arm strength, the intelligence, the leadership, the pocket awareness. I mean, all the things you look for in a quarterback, aside from maybe another 3 inches of height and a hip that hasn't been surgically repaired, he checks all those boxes.
All I want to know is this. Is it time to finally buy my Tua jersey? That's it. That's all I want to know. I think I will. That's the Miami Herald's Adam Beasley. Again, read more coverage on the Dolphins on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, November 12th. Coming up next week on the show, we're going to continue to keep you updated on local election recounts that are happening throughout South Florida. A number of races were too close to call. They're going through the electronic recount process now. Plus, the Miami Book Fair kicks off virtually on Sunday. We're going to bring you a special conversation with author Judy Bloom and WLRN's editorial director, Alicia Zuckerman. And if you want to read more about this year's book fair and all the offerings, just go to WLRN.org. And musicians have been forced to innovate because of the pandemic. Performers at the Frost School of Music have put together a rock concert all about performing while in quarantine. All of that's coming up next week on the show. As always, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Find the podcast on your podcast app. Just look up WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe, be good to each other, have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.